Are you ready for new dimensions and countless possibilities today and for the future? It's an exciting new time, and the answers are out there. So join Mary Jane Popp as she explores the unique and unusual for a better life on Pop Talk in search of the truth. And here she is, Mary Jane Popp.
You betcha we're always in search of truth and also in touch with entertainment and fun and making life positive and just going forward and saying, we're going to make it through all of this. So I've got a couple of guests that are going to help us do that because they've done some remarkable things on both television, on the big screen, and you will be surprised and pleasantly surprised, I might add. So hang in there. It's Pop Talk. We do go in search of truth.
Sunday, Monday, happy days. Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days. The weekend comes.
So who does not remember that iconic television show, Happy Days? Well, do you remember Fonzie's girlfriend? How about Matlock, which was one of my favorite programs with the Andy Griffith, of course, and his daughter. She played his daughter. But I can mention The Office, Showtime's Homeland. I can go on and on and on. And Linda Pearl has starred in over 45 television movies. Oh, and television series, of course. And I need to mention that she has released 5 CDs. The latest is called This Could Be the Start. Now, she does a worldwide cabaret show. She's currently recurring in After Forever as Dr. Evelyn Meyer on Amazon Prime Video. So she's done it all and more to come. Hi, Linda. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, absolutely. Now, do you have a favorite TV show or it just depends on each one?
It does depend. It's like having to choose between children. It's impossible. You know, it's everyone has its own adventure and its own family of new friends and sometimes old friends. And
yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, the reason I'm asking is because, you know, Fonzie on Happy Days, unbelievable. I've talked to Anson Williams. I've talked to, Marion Ross. And everybody says that the people on the set had a family feeling and that everybody seemed to be pretty happy on Happy Days. What do you think?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. And, you know, that atmosphere doesn't come about by accident. I mean, it's, you know, wonderful people involved. Of course, the ingredients in the stew were great. But Gary Marshall insisted on that. He knew, I think, as did Jerry Paris, that you couldn't really do that kind of lighthearted comedy if that wasn't the atmosphere that we were living in and breathing in and working in. So when you came through onto stage 17 on the Paramount lot, everybody sort of left their earth weights outside, and it was a delightful place to be. It was very joyful, and that was that atmosphere pervaded for all the years of the show.
Amazing. Was that the same thing on Matlock? Because I was a fan of Matlock. I still watch some of the reruns. I love it.
Matlock was very different, but I'll tell you where that atmosphere was very similar was on the set of The Office. And I was nervous going in to The Office because it was such a well-established show, and I was a new kid on the block, and I just thought, oh, God, what is it going to be like? But it was great. And in that case, again, they were wonderful, incredibly smart, talented people. But Steve Carell, you know, he just made it so. By the time I came into the show, they had already enjoyed such a huge success with it that they could have been jaded, but it wasn't that way. Steve and I think, therefore, everyone came to work, like first day of school, excited to be there, working hard, ready, prepared. So that was interesting. I couldn't have imagined that I would luck into 2 such happy work circumstances.
Amazing. Well, now, I also have to ask you because, I mean, these are such different shows, Happy Days and Matlock, Office, Homeland. Uh-huh. How do you take on a character?
How do I take on a character?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the better the writing is, the easier it gets. And I've been very fortunate to be able to have really good writers, the scripts that I've been working with.
Uh-huh.
But it, I think, first of all, you take in the tone or the theme of the show. That has to inform your choices. And then so much of it becomes shaped by what you're getting from your fellow actor and hopefully what you're giving to them. So it's a real team effort. And it happens very quickly. It's very different from theater, where you get to rehearse and do the same piece, you know, 8 times a week for however long your run is. I mean, two yeah. weeks, 3 weeks, 5 years. I've never done a run for 5 years, but I have for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Well, so the animal is very different.
Well, the thing, too, is you've done it all. I mean, you've done stage and with that live audience. How do you continue to have that same feel when you just have the cameras? There's not that audience feel. Do you know what I mean? I've been on live stage, and so you get that feeling from the audience. They nurture you. They live with you. They laugh with you. They cry with you. But you don't have that with the cameras.
Well, it's funny. I asked Robert Preston. I had the chance to work with him, and of course, He had done it all. He'd done a lot of Broadway, done a lot of great film roles. So we were doing a TV movie together, and I said, "Mr. Preston, don't you miss the live audience when you're doing film?" And he said, "Oh, no, honey. I take that proscenium arch, and I just pull it around my shoulders." And he said, "You will never find a more sophisticated, experienced audience than a Hollywood crew."
Uh-huh.
And it was like stating the obvious, but it was such a brilliant statement. It's true. Those designers, those grips, those camera operators, they've heard dialogue and they've seen, 12 and 18 hours a day for decades. They've seen actors ply their wares,
mm-hmm.
and they are savvy.
Wow.
So, and you get a lot from them, too. They are usually focused on the work. They have to stop everything else they're doing while you're working. So
they got to pay attention.
They have to pay attention.
Yeah.
And they do pay attention, yeah.
So is it fun to take on the different personalities?
Very much so. You mentioned Anson Williams, and I'm just started memorizing a play that Anson is going to direct me in Ventura in California. And it's a wonderful, it's a one-woman play. It's a 64-page monologue, which is scary. But his wife wrote it, and Sharon is from Virginia. Her kin, or she was raised in Virginia, where my kin is from.
Mm-hmm.
And her mother had a psychotic break when Sharon was a little girl.
Ooh.
And in many ways, it shaped her childhood and life with the collateral damage that this caused in her family. So she wrote a journal, you know, with the hindsight, as an adult, late 50s or whenever, she wrote a journal about it. And then Anson said, "That's lovely, honey. Now you need to turn that into a play."
Whoa.
Which he has. And so Anson's going to direct me in his wife's play, and where I take on 16 characters.
Oh, my word.
In the play. So, you know, that's fun. But Anson and I were saying the other day, when we met each other over 50 years ago now, we could never have imagined this long weave of friendship, you know, that our lives keep circling back into each other's story.
Mm-hmm. That is a mess. I haven't gotten past the 60-some pages, you know.
Me neither.
And,
yeah.
And all the characters that you have to portray, because you have to have them all like compartmentalized, don't you?
I think so. I mean, I've done a one-woman show before, but I've never portrayed different characters. So, believe me, it's a learning process for me. I think once you kind of get a sense of the essence of each person, and you ascribe some specific body language to them, hopefully it'll be clearer to the, you know, to the audience. We'll
now,
find out.
What came to you first? What, the singing or the acting?
It was the acting. although when I grew up in Japan and started doing musicals there as a child, so the music was pretty much on the heels, but my focus was always as an actress who happened to sing. And then I guess in my 20s or something, I wasn't doing music. I didn't get cast in musicals in New York. And then once I had moved to Los Angeles at 18 and doing, television work, there was certainly no music there, and I really started to miss music. Well, I guess at some point briefly in my 20s, I was had a recording contract in Japan, so I'd go back and record a little bit. But that's very different from doing 8 shows a week of a musical, and I missed it. So about that time, the horrible AIDS epidemic had started, and
oh, wow,
everybody was just trying to do whatever they could. And in Los Angeles, for many years, there was this huge production of fundraisers, big, big variety shows, and people came. They were so generous in their support, and all the funds raised from that would go to AIDS research and to support those suffering with AIDS. It was, you know, it was an epidemic. It was a terrible, terrible time. So, but I started to do those, and so I was now in with musicians, and one thing led to another, and at some point, someone said, why don't you do a cabaret act, which is about the scariest thing I'd ever heard. I think I was about 30 at the time.
Uh-huh.
So I started, and the brilliant thing, which I hadn't realized about cabaret, is that you have autonomy in it.
Yes.
As an actor or an actress, you sit around a fair amount of the time waiting for the phone to ring. Well, if you're doing cabaret, you can get together with your music director and create a show, and then you can call around to a few clubs, and somebody's going to book you. So suddenly you can be proactive for something that you love to do, and over the years, it has become increasingly a more important part of my life. I never went into it with the idea of it having to be how I made my living. It was really for the joy, the adventure of it, the learning curve of it, and the discipline. It means now I have some concerts in 10 days or so coming up in Florida at Del Rey, and then I'll be doing one not too far from you in Orinda.
Oh, yeah.
And in Northern California.
Is it going to be like at the Orinda Theater or?
Yes, at the Orinda Theater. Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, Derek Zemrek, who runs the Orinda, good friend.
Yes. Oh, what a great guy. Great guy.
He's fantastic.
Yeah.
And he always helps everybody to be the best they can be, which is great.
I believe it. Yeah. I believe it. Well, we'll be with him on March 23rd. But what that means is that, you know, I have to do my little sit-ups and do my scales and keep my lyrics sharp. And it's just a nice discipline. I'm lazy by nature, but, you know, vanity prevails. And if I know I have a show coming up, I kind of keep at it. So I'm grateful for that.
How did the...
those little goals ahead in your life.
Yeah. How did the pandemic hit you or how affect you?
Well, I'm embarrassed to say it ended up being full of good surprises for me. I was living in New York at the time, and I was doing a play and loved it. So happy living in New York and so happy doing this beautiful play. It was an original piece. I had bumped into an old acquaintance, a 40-year acquaintance before the pandemic, a couple of months before, and uh-huh. He had lost touch with a mutual friend, so I put them back in touch. Anyway, we had each other's texts and things, and we'd say, you know, Happy Christmas, but there was nothing there. Then he said, oh, I'm coming to New York, so let's just, with our mutual friend, let's get together, maybe we can have a drink. Then the pandemic hit.
Ooh.
So I left New York. I have a primary residence in Colorado, and so I, you know, living in Colorado all by my lonesome, stuck in the mountains. I mean, it was beautiful, but it was bizarre.
Oh, yeah.
It was like a science fiction film, and because New York was shuttered. Within 72 hours, New York was shuttered.
Yeah.
So this friend and I started, his name is Patrick Duffy, so we started to text, how are you doing? He was also sort of shuttered in his home in Oregon, and we would text occasionally. Then we FaceTimed at some point, and before long, we started to Zoom every night for 2 to 3 hours.
Wow.
And somewhere along the line, it was the possibility that there was something more than this nice sort of collegial friendship.
Uh-oh.
And so he, after 3 months, he got in his car and he drove, because nobody could fly at that time.
Yeah.
He drove to Colorado, and that was that. And, you know, I mean, we never would have made the time or found the time to have that those hours every day to get to know each other. And it was this sort of Victorian, journey. But it was it didn't start with any expectation. So I think it just sort of surprised us both.
Yeah.
And so that was a big change.
So are you a couple now?
We are. We have been for 4.5 years.
Aww.
And, we've had a chance to work together. We've done we did a tour in England for 7 months, and we did a movie of the week. And,
nice.
We've done love letters a few times, and so, you know, fun.
Good for you. So what does Linda Pearl care about? I mean, really, really, her passion. What is her passion?
Oh, my. Well, I think, you know, it's really hard to narrow things down. But at this stage of my life, I feel like I'm at the legacy stage, so everything I do matters. A friend, you know, was sharing that emotion, and he said everything he does has to align with his core values. And so I love that idea. And there are many things I care about. I mean, I'm very fortunate to have a strong family and a rich treasure trove of friends who are chosen family. So I care about that, I would say, first and foremost. And Patrick and my relationship is right in there, of course.
Oh,
I think I care about health. I mean, it's just something that you, enjoy to do. But cultivating joy is important. I have a strong spiritual practice. That's a daily practice for me. I find that sustains. I rely on that for my resilience.
Good for
you.
I do.
I just couldn't without it. There are things I don't know. I don't want to say scared about, but troubled by in our world. You know, I think everybody is, no matter what side of the fence you're on.
Very much Very much.
So I worry about the tone of anger and hate. Mm. It's certainly never been at this level.
No.
That in my lifetime, I've never imagined such a thing in my home country. I don't know really what to do. I asked, this is very name-droppy, but I asked a friend of mine who had been a world leader at some point, and I just said, what would you, what do you advise to a concerned citizen? And she said, well, be resilient, stay informed, and hold to your friends, support each other.
Yeah.
And support someone when they need and ask them for your support when you're in need. So that sounded like pretty solid advice,
Who was that person? Can you mention?
Resilience. Be resilient.
No.
Yeah.
The person that gave you the advice.
Oh, she was a world leader. She had been a premier of Canada, actually, at some point. So,
okay.
And a very smart, lovely woman. I, having just come through the fires in Los Angeles, very, very, very lucky. We were evacuated for 8 days, and we've now have stopped counting how many friends and acquaintances have lost their houses there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Many with the shirt on their back. But so, of course, after this, and you know, this is climate change, clearly. So I worry about climate change. I mean, it's something we will have to be increasingly dealing with. So,
yes.
You know, I do worry about that. I will hasten to add that I have never lived through, well, that's not true. I lived through the earthquake in Los Angeles many years ago, but somehow the fires were different because it was ongoing. It was so many days, and so many forces had to be mobilized.
And they couldn't be stopped.
It couldn't be stopped.
I'm sick and tired of people coming up, well, they should have done this. You were not there. You don't know.
Well, there was nothing to be done. I, as our mayor, who, you know, said this was hurricane force winds with no rain. So I can't imagine the agony of all of the pilots sitting on the ground,
and
planes and helicopters loaded, ready to go, and they could not take off.
No.
Because the wind, I mean, first of all, if you dropped anything, it would not hit its target. There were gusts of wind over 100 miles an hour. So, you know, you couldn't fight it.
Yeah.
Couldn't fight it.
And
just embers, had to let it burn.
Embers just, you know, in the air with that hurricane winds, and it would go for miles and then drop down, start another fire. I mean, you can't
stop that.
That's, you know, Mother Nature, I think, got really upset with us and just said, I'll take everything out right now.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
For
That's
sure.
amazing. So do you have, I always love to ask people about this, two things. One, do you have a philosophy of life?
Oh, goodness, that's a big question.
It's a big ask.
My mother liked to say, oh, honey, when those hurdles come, just keep hurdling. And it's so simple. I mean, I think life comes in seasons, and there are pruning seasons, and there are blooming seasons, and I think that, you know, it's never really the end of the story. I mean, even with death, if your spiritual belief leads you in that direction. So, I mean, life can present terrors and down-ins and valleys and beautiful mountaintops, but it really does move like water. And I think in those moments when, certainly I've experienced them, where I don't know, there just doesn't seem to be any possibility. You just seem like you're up against it, that even if you can just start with a simple breath, even if you have to take it, you know, 10 seconds at a time, you can get through. And so I think that's something, I don't know that that's a philosophy, but it is something that I've learned in life. I've experienced it.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's beautiful.
So,
one other question. If you step out of yourself and step away a few steps and turn around and look at Linda Pearl and tell me, and I know this is even harder than the philosophy, in 25 words or less, who is Linda Pearl?
Oh, my goodness. I have a close group of girlfriends. We've known each other since we were little girls, and we live all over the world now, but we get together every couple of years. And so we knew each other's parents. We've known each other before we started to imagine our adult lives and moved into it. So we kind of have an essence of each other that we know. And one of these get-togethers, we went around the table, and we each spoke to the other, to one girl at a time, just saying, this is who I know you to be. And it was really fun. And it was, I think that everybody was surprised. It was like, really? That's who I am? But on reflection, they were pretty, they were pretty
on target,
accurate.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Who am I? It's just, I mean, does it ever end? Is the learning curve about yourself or your journey ever end? I mean, I would hope that I'm a fairly positive person. I'd like to think of myself as being loyal. I cleave to love and friendship in my life. So I'm going to fail this question.
No, you didn't. I'll add one more thing. A talented person. You won't say it,
oh,
but
thank
I
you.
Will. I will. Do you have a website?
Thank you very much. I do. It's lindapearl.com.
Oh, okay.
And there's more information that you would ever need or want, or anyway, the dates of, let's see, we're doing Delray in Florida, February 10 to 12, and then Anson's Play in Ventura is March 26th to April 12th, something like that. And then, yeah, so anyway, people, I'd love to, you know, here's the thing about live performance. You just think, oh, my gosh, anybody going to buy a ticket and come? It's a terror. You just think, yeah. Oh, are we going to sell tickets? So please, I implore your audience to go to the website, and if you're anywhere near us, to, you know, stuff as many people as you can in your Volkswagen and come down and see us.
I love it. Linda, I'm so glad that we had you on the show. I hope you'll come back again.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It was a delightful interview.
Thank you so much. Take good care of yourself and the best of everything, because you deserve it.
Thank you.
Once again, Linda Pearl, lindapearl.com. You can go to all the, because she's going to be doing cabaret shows a lot and all kinds of different things, like with Anson Williams, etc. She's the best. I'm looking forward to having her back again. And coming up, we've got one of the meanies, and I mean nasties, from Karate Kid, who's going to be with us. So hang in there. It's Pop Talk, and you know, we just keep on going. It's hot to the max in the summer, and your air conditioner gives up the ghost. Who are you going to call? ACP Mechanical, that's who. I did, and I can't believe what a great job they did in my home. It's cool and comfortable with a job well done. Hi, Mary Jane Pop here. Whether it's cooling or heating, Enrique and his ACP Mechanical team can install, repair, commercial or residential, no matter what HVAC system you have or want, and they've done it for over 20 years. Air conditioners, heat pumps, furnaces, thermostats, all quality and affordable solutions, and they're bonded and insured. I know you'll love their work. I do. Call ACP Mechanical, 916-704-8556. That's 916-704-8556 for all your comfort needs. That's ACP Mechanical, 916-704-8556, and expect an expert job well done and right the first time. Now, that music, if you were a fan of The Karate Kid and, what, 2 and 3, there were three of those movies, then you'll know that theme song. Yeah, it's just amazing, the changes that we've seen in theater, of course, with the pandemic, etc. But in the movies, there are the white hats and the black hats. That's the good guys and the bad guys. And Martin Cove wore both of these hats, but being a villain is where he shined, as he portrayed John Kreese, the head instructor of the Cobra Kai Karate School. And he was a real meanie. And the original Karate Kid and two sequels, in all three of them, over 80 appearances to date, and more to come for this major, major talent. Martin, it's a pleasure to have you with us on Pop Talk.
Well, thank you, Mary. Thank you.
Now, have you ever referred? You've been referred to as the Han Solo of steroids. Is that true?
Maybe come a little louder. It's a little hard to hear you.
Oh, okay. You've been referred to as the Han Solo on steroids.
Who referred to me like that?
I don't know. I just read it someplace, and I thought, I got to ask him about that. Do you think you were the Han Solo, you know? No.
Han Solo, I mean, Harrison does, you know, Indiana Jones, and, you know, it was a precursor to Indiana Jones. So, on steroids, I never thought of myself as that, you know. I guess you could referred to that, because the character is so wrapped up in his way or the highway.
Yeah.
And he's so wrapped up in integrity and taking chances despite the individual jeopardy he can put himself into.
Amazing.
You know,
yeah.
I was watching Christopher Reeve's documentary.
Oh, yeah.
I watched it Tuesday night, and it was really interesting because he finishes the documentary with what I identified with it so much because he didn't want to be only considered to be a Superman. He did it in many other movies, and it was very frustrating for him.
Sure.
To break away from that image of Superman, and it's very frustrating for me to break away from the heavy.
Really?
You know, because all these movies, I mean, I did a Hallmark movie, and I was a romantic restaurateur, and I cry in the show, and I'm the father of this wonderful lead, and you do a lot of great stuff coming up in Cobra Kai, you know, in the final five, and all vulnerable, all touching, all romantic. And I'm the kind of guy that cries at supermarket opening.
Oh, that's great.
So I truly identify with that plight of Christopher Reeves and movie trying to move through into, different kind of roles. And I understand that being pigeonholed,
Yeah.
And so it's actually a compliment that someone says Han Solo, because Han Solo wasn't a heavy. Even if he was on steroids, he was a hero. And that's kind of like what I think, unfortunately, is missing in today's society.
Boy, and how.
Kids don't have any heroes.
Yeah, you're right. Not
sci-fi heroes.
But the thing is...
Not Marvel heroes.
I didn't know that you have black belts in certain kinds of, I think, the only thing I think about is, taekwondo, karate. But it's kendo, Okinawa Te and Tiger Kempo. Are those just like variations of karate?
Okinawa Te, they're styles. It's called styles.
Styles.
And Okinawa Te was created in Okinawa by farmers who had to fight with their farm weapons, rakes and shovels and whatever, against the samurai, of the local warlord. So it became called Okinawa Te. Te is hand, open hand. And in this case, kendo is sword work. And I was, I became more familiar with kendo with a slight foundation of karate because we were in training before Karate Kid for a movie called Lion of Ireland, which was from a book written by Morgan Llewellyn. And it was all about the first king of Ireland who unified the tribes against the Vikings.
Oh.
And we all learned, how to fight with swords. And it was that period of time when Conan was popular and a lot of samurai work was being used in sword work rather than broadswords like in Vikings or broadswords like, in the era of the Round Table Knight. It was a different style.
Gotcha.
So we learned a lot combining karate with kendo, which is the sword work, and that's what we were doing. Then the movie got canceled. A month later, I was doing Karate Kid, and the foundation was there, but none of us really had. It was never a prerequisite that any of the actors had to be martial artists. We all worked with Pat Johnson, and Pat Johnson was the stunt coordinator of Batman and Ninja Turtles and was, Chuck Norris's partner for 20 years on the international scene in the 60s and 70s, and they were partners, and they were brilliant.
Wow.
So he coordinated all of us separately, alone, trained me alone, trained Cobra Kai alone, trained Ralph and Pat Morita alone, and to create the mystique.
Amazing. And you actually got hurt in Karate Kid 3, right?
In 2.
Two, okay. What happened?
I had to put my hand through the window at the top of the movie.
Uh-oh.
Fighting Pat Morita. And I had to punch through a glass in a van. And the special effects man said, don't worry, you can, it'll break an inch before you reach it, and it'll shatter. I'm going to shatter it with gunpowder in the door of the van. It never happened. And I punched and punched and punched, and, I would hit the glass, but it wouldn't break. And then he says, I fixed it, so now we can do it.
Uh-oh.
And I didn't lunge, I just punched, because I didn't believe him. and I went right through the glass, real glass. The charge in the door never went off. And I came out with shards of glass sticking in my fist.
Oh, no.
Big shards of glass. You know, and thank God it didn't hit a vein or an artery.
Yeah.
And they patched me up. And John Avildsen, the director, tried it an hour later after putting new skin on my fist and makeup. And then I did the scene again and punched. And I held back because I didn't believe this guy was going to charge it properly.
Mm-hmm.
And the window didn't break. And I hit right against it, but I just was careful.
Yeah.
I turned to John Avildsen and I said, John, this is the hand of Martin Cove. This is not the hand of Arnold in The Terminator.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, okay, that's a wrap. You know, and we used the real scene of me going through the window. And the next day we shot me coming out of the window, you know, coming back. And it was just, you know, it was cinema then.
Ouch.
But, yeah, you know, it's just part of the game, I guess, you know.
But, you know, there's a quote that I read, and you have to tell me if it's true or not, but you said that from the moment you got to Hollywood, you've always felt like you really never got to do what you wanted to do. Is that true?
Yeah, it's kind of true. I mean, doing A Taste of Love for Hallmark, which you can get, I think, on Prime Video and see it. I did it with my son. You know, I've always wanted, you know, I love Westerns, and I think that the kids need those kind of heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And I lucked into doing a Gunsmoke in the first year I was in Hollywood. It was the last year of Gunsmoke, and I had a ball. But it's always been, you know, the first year I was in Hollywood, I did like 3 movies and 8 TV shows. But they were all tough guys.
Yeah.
All tough guys.
Yeah.
And, I always wanted to be a romantic. I just, you know, I just, my idols, and I was trying to be Steve McQueen for the first 20 years of my career. And, you know, I finally found that it was okay to be Martin Cove, you know, probably 15 years ago. But I think while I was doing Cagney and Lacey, or maybe when the kids were born, I think when my twins were born, all of a sudden I realized that it was okay.
Aww.
Because the focus came off of business. It just was watching them sleep in the crib. So I kind of realized that the romantic roles or the vulnerable roles would slowly come, and here and there. So I never really got to do a good romantic lead, you know? And I'd like to do that. I would love to do some of those things that Thomas Crown Affair, you know, so many, you know, HUD, so many of those characters of the actors that I emulated and loved. McQueen and Newman were my favorites. And, you know, I just...
I understand.
No matter how many plays you do... Go ahead, Dolly.
I was going to say, it's interesting that you say, you know, especially like about a cowboy. Perry King, he's become a good friend, and he's on the show periodically. I have him come back. He used to do Riptide and Slaughterhouse-Five and all that. And he always wanted to be, do a cowboy movie. And he actually did his own movie, an independent movie, about 3 years ago, 3-4 years ago. And he did it on his own ranch in Northern California. And he felt so good that he did. It was an independent film. He took care of everything. And he directed it. He starred in it. And he said that was the culmination he felt on his life of, you know, being in so many different movies and television and everything. And, you know, I think most actors have something. They have a dream. Something is inside that says, this is what I want to do. And when they do it, they feel gratified. I've done it. I did what I wanted to do, my dream. And it'd be nice if you can do whatever you want. Would a dream be just being a romantic, or a cowboy, or both?
It's kind of both, you know. I have a project that is that's becoming a graphic novel.
Oh.
And it's 4 issues of a comic book. and it's called The Prodigal Son. And it's the story of the bonding and the exchange of moral fiber with an old gunfighter, who I play, and a 12-year-old boy. And they become, the boy hasn't got a violent background, and he becomes a survivalist. He learns how to survive. And his parents are killed and all that, and we're both hunting the same gang. And I'm an old curmudgeon who's a great gunfighter who is now learning the values of real life, of love, and the bonding that goes on. Mm-hmm. And a woman is involved. And it's really a project where it's my dream project because my son will play the bad guy. Uh-huh. And I've done several projects with my son, Jesse, and he's very good. And it is a dream to do that because I've always wanted, you know, I've wanted to do the Western, but I wanted to do it like John Wayne did Red River and The Searchers. You know, I based my character, John Kreese, this year on Ethan Edwards, the character that John Wayne played in The Searchers.
Oh.
And, you know, there's so much good writing out there, and yet we don't focus enough on it. We focus too much on sci-fi and heroes about, you know, the heroes that are helped through special effects.
Yeah.
But I want a vulnerable hero that very much with the soul of, as we spoke about, Indiana Jones, the soul of John Wayne in the Red River or The Searchers. You know, there's a wonderful soul there that's different than just being impregnable as a Marvel hero.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Kids need to see that. I need kids to see it.
Real people. Real people with real emotions,
yeah.
And real something inside. There's something inside, the heart and the soul of that person.
Yeah, exactly. And the kids have a rough time with that now. No one's running around saying, "Mommy, I want to be president. Mommy, I want to be, can I be John Wayne? Can we do Clint Eastwood?" They're all gone.
Yeah.
You know, those images are all gone. So the kids need, that's why I want to do this as a series, you know.
That would be great.
It's on the way, you know, it's on the way.
Is it really? Do you have, you know, any projection dates yet or anything?
No, we're now, you know, dealing with some, you know, showrunners, and all four comic books are done, and there's a big convention in L.A., and it's very exciting. And then you own the IP, which I do, and then you basically have a graphic novel, and it's all sold as literature, and people like to make TV series that have a background of a book. You know, that's how they did all those miniseries years ago.
Yeah,
You know, Roots, Rich Man, Poor Man, all that.
That would make a great series, TV series. Absolutely.
Yeah, it really would. And there's a wonderful woman's part in there. And it's all about moral. It's all about, you know, human values. And not everything has to be so... It's lots of conflict. But not everything has to be so violent, you know?
Yeah. I'm so sick and tired of seeing everything blown up or shooted up. Or, you know, it's just like, come on. Can't we just tell a story? A story that stays with you when you leave the theater or you turn the TV set off. You know what I mean?
I had a fascinating experience. I was in Nashville and I went to see one movie and I didn't like it. So I left and I went to the box office and I said, what can I see now? It's 10 to 10. And they said, well, you can see the Bob Dylan movie. So I went next door, saw the Bob Dylan movie, and I loved it. Just loved it. You know, A Complete Unknown.
Wow.
A wonderful movie.
Wow.
And while I'm walking out, there's a dozen kids, 15, 16 years old. And, of course, they were Cobra Kai fans. And, you know, we started chat. And once we got outside the theater, they said to me, did you see the movie? And I said, yeah, I saw the Bob Dylan movie. And they were so articulate and so interested. And these are 15, 16-year-old high school kids out of a Tennessee high school. And they were so articulate and interested in the 60s, interested in Bob Dylan, interested in, you know, all those songs that he wrote, I Got You, Babe, you know, just endless, not only just like a Rolling Stone, but the earlier stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And I loved it. I loved the fact that these kids, who pretty much have been spoiled by technology, you know, and the art of being personable has kind of floated away.
Yeah.
Because everybody relies on their cell phone for this and that. Now, these kids were right where I wanted the generation to be.
Yeah.
Inquisitive about the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, meaningful movies, great imagination, things that sort of Bob Dylan represented, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, there were stories. Yeah, I wish when I see some movies, tell me a story, something that I can get involved in. I mean, if you go back to even some of the old movies in 40s and 50s, you got hooked in. You know, you wanted to see what was going to happen. You wanted to see the ending. It made an impact on you at the end. Those are hard to find these days.
Yeah, they're not writing those. I mean, my favorite movie is Casablanca.
Oh, of course.
And, you know, they're not, it's just not writing those stories. It, oddly enough, on Hallmark, The Taste of Love was like that. And it wasn't too schmaltzy, you know?
Yeah.
It was a story of love and food. And it was really, really terrific that I did it. And my son was in it, and everything just worked out. The chemistry was terrific.
That's great.
And it's all the words. The reason why Cobra Kai works is because, you know, how many people tried to, like, do Karate Kid on the screen again and do it as a serious...
No.
And it never worked.
No.
But the writing of Cobra Kai, of all of us, even through these last five episodes that air on the 12th of February, the resolution of the characters, these, you know, writers were a year and a half ahead of any notes, any desires you had, any anticipations of what your character could do, the dramatic arcs. You could make any of the notes you want to about what you'd like your character to do, and they were already ahead of you because they knew the characters by a year and a half to 2 years before they even did what was cinematically explained in the series.
Wow.
I mean, it's all in the writing. It's all in the literature. It's unquestionable.
So you've got twins, a boy and a girl?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
My kids, they're just great. My daughter's a life coach, and my son's an actor, and got so many projects coming out, and he's, you know, far more logical than I was. You know, at his age.
How did you get started in acting?
I think it was in the fourth grade, and I did a play called The Golden Goose, and I loved it. It was in Brooklyn, and I just loved being on stage and just cultivated it. And I was a fantasist, and I was the only child, and I was adopted.
Uh-huh.
And my parents weren't in the business at all. You know,
mm-hmm.
they were, my mother was a bookkeeper, my father was a hardware retailer.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
And, you know, and they just always supported me being, you know, an imaginative soul and setting up your soldiers in the morning and having your battle the next day and going to see as many plays as you can and watch and religiously going to films like The Ten Commandments and Around the World in 80 Days.
Oh, yeah.
El Cid. All these great historical movies that I was in love with. I was in love with history.
Uh-huh.
You know. And they appreciated that. And then when I was 20, I moved out of the house and, you know, moved into the city and worked in Lincoln Center and did a lot of off-Broadway work. And then in 74, I just came to L.A., you know.
Uh-huh.
And... wanted to do good projects and, you know, became a member of a theater group. And, you know, we just got back to our roots. And I think it was with Ed Harris, and Holly Hunter, and Amy Madigan, and Alfred Woodard. We all joined created the Met Theater. Paul Coslow and, you know, Laura Owens. And we created the theater just to, it was, you know, constantly writing checks. Because no one ever came. You know, no one really came. you got to finance. L.A. isn't a theater town, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So you got to really, you got to do it for you, you know?
So where were you raised?
I was raised in Brooklyn and Queens.
Oh, okay.
And, we moved from Brooklyn to Queens, and I was raised there. And still a nice neighborhood. I go back, showed my son the apartment complex we lived in. And then I moved into the Village and started doing theater and making it easier because I was living in Manhattan and just, you know, working.
And the rest is history, huh?
The rest is history. You know, they're writing a book on me, but it's not about Karate Kid or Cobra Kai. It's about tenacity.
Ooh, I like that.
What I believe, what I push my son in. You know, if they make, if they don't hire you, their mistake.
There you go. Anybody that asked me if anything in the media or acting or anything, I said, you know, if you don't have the skin of an elephant, don't go into the business. Because you're going to get a lot of hits, and it has nothing to do with you. It's them, not you. So I'm glad you're giving that advice. When is the book going to be out soon?
Well, we're just in the midst of doing it, so one doesn't really know. I would say the end of the year.
Okay.
It's fascinating. Because my first reaction was, I'm not book worthy.
You know, sure,
Anthony
you
Hopkins
are.
Is book worthy. Yes. Peter O'Toole's. Yeah, but the angle of it was coming from, the writer would say, you come from no connections in Hollywood. You come from parents who were, you know, just middle class, you know,
folk.
Jewish people.
Ordinary
who just
folk. Yeah.
Loved, you know, they just loved you.
Yeah.
And you were able to keep going and keep going. And, you know, I never had to do anything else. So it was good. But, you go up and down emotionally and you search for that level of self-satisfaction and you're always seeking, you know, love in one respect or another. But the business, you know, there's no formula to making film, really.
Yeah.
There's no formula to why, other than good literature, good writing, there's no formula to why shows work, you know?
Yeah.
I think everybody wants to make a movie that's a blockbuster. But the interesting thing is that while you're shooting, you have great aspirations, but it's very few movies that know they got a hit.
Yeah.
They know. Yeah. When Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, I was reading about that, when they shot that movie, the chemistry was so rich, they knew they had a hit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And probably, you know, Star Wars didn't know. He didn't know he had a hit. And Godfather, there's that wonderful, wonderful show called The Offer, which is all about the producer, Al Ruddy, and how he dealt with obstacles.
Yeah.
I tell every young actor to watch The Offer.
Gotcha.
It's on Paramount Plus.
Now,
and
Martin, we're running
they
short.
Didn't know they had a hit. In the,
we're know. Running short of time. Doggone it. Now, do you have a website?
Yeah, it's martincove.com.
Okay.
And, the Instagram is there, and you can always just look me up on Instagram. And all the pictures and backgrounds and all of that stuff, you know.
All the good stuff about Martin Cove, which is great.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with me. We've got so much more we could talk about. Can I invite you back again sometime?
Oh, certainly, darling, absolutely.
Yeah,
you ask some nice questions.
Well, I ask questions that I know my folks who are listening would be asking. And it's like what real life is all about. You know what I mean? We need more of that. We need more of those stories, good stories, positive stories, and you're one of them.
Well, thank you.
Take good care now. Well, have a safe trip back to L.A., and we'll talk again soon.
All right, very good.
Take care
of yourself.
You too. MartinCove.com, K-O-V-E. And just remember a couple of things. Be yourself. Everyone else is already taken. So be you and be unique. In the meantime, as I always say, live simply, laugh often, love deeply, and above all else, dare to dream. How do you make a dream come true if you didn't have a dream to begin with? Talk with you next time on Pop Talk.